It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we meet a project in Sheboygan that puts elders and their life stories in the spotlight as a way to help their memories and experiences live forever. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt from the new podcast, Humanity Unlocked, which is focusing on people impacted by the justice system here in Wisconsin.
Tattoos can tell the story of a person's life. They feature aesthetic beauty, inside jokes, or family memories. Some of Daniel Schleicher's tattoos memorialize his favorite people. His story comes to us from the Odyssey Beyond Bars project, which provides classes for students incarcerated in Wisconsin.
I'm a little nervous, I ain't gonna lie to y'all. So bear with me. All right, so my story's called Penguins, Bears, and Tattoos, Oh My. When I was a kid, I looked up to Kenny. I wish he was my dad. He wasn't. Kenny was, in fact, my two older sisters' dad. I remember him coming over to our house to pick up my sisters for his weekend to have them. I never understood why I couldn't go with them. It was clear I was a likable kid, how he played basketball with me while waiting for them to get ready, which felt like forever. Yet it was probably just minutes. In those moments of shooting hoops, I would even pretend he was my dad, but Kenny wasn't my dad. He wasn't my stepdad. He was, however, a father figure, and I honor him today in calling him my bonus dad. I only wish I could have told him this, for those moments spent with him meant a lot to me. You see, Kenny passed away in 1994, and what he doesn't know is he played such an important part of my life and had a role in my love for tattoos. He had several himself, and the only one I remember was a tattoo of a penguin on his hand. So to a boy looking up to this man, I just thought this was what men do, is get tattoos. I got my first tattoo at the age of 13 in a friend's garage. It was a nickname friends called me back then, and it was difficult to hide from my mother. And now that I'm older, several tattoos later, it's still getting difficult to hide them from my mother. I never had a scheme to my madness of tattoos other than if I wanted something somewhere, I got it. I'm tattooed literally head to toe. I can't say I have a favorite. I have some I want to cover and many more I want to get. I do, however, have some that got me through some dark times with just a glance, like my children's names on my fingers that I see every moment of the day. There's my mother's name on my arm, as she's been the strength and my unconditional love. I have my granddaughter's handprint over my heart because she's a piece of my heart in human form. And I have my last name, Schleicher, which is Kenny's last name, that I carry on for him. I also have a rose tattoo for him with Rest in Peace Kenneth and the date he passed. And yet my mind comes back to that penguin tattoo. That tattoo created a love for penguins that runs so deep. I customized my own penguin stuffed animals for my kids and granddaughter when I was in Columbia Correctional Institute. I used to work for the Incel Teddy Bear Project, and that's where I had the opportunity to do so. I've drawn cards and pictures of penguins for them. And when I did beadwork, I made those tiny penguins that fit on the tops of pens, and their little arms would flop all upside down with each pen stroke. That's not where my love stops. I had penguins looked up to discover that they only mate once in their lifetime, and on an occasion, if the mate dies, they will move on. The male even goes as far to find a pebble or a rock, like a diamond, that he kicks around until he presents it to the female. If that is not a true love story for you, then I don't know what is. I decided I'd like to get a penguin tattoo in memory of Kenny. I wanted the exact tattoo or close to, so I wrote home asking for photos of these in order to draw it. That's when I discovered my whole life was a lie, that Kenny did not have a penguin tattoo on his hand like I remembered. He had, in fact, a bear tattoo. And not just any bear, but the Ham's Bear from Ham's Beer. Okay, in all fairness, this was over 30 years ago, and I only had minutes with the man, and the ink back then was not a good quality. So this tattoo was mistaken as a penguin. You can see it. Yeah. Now you know how I feel. Now I have to get this Ham's Bear tattoo in memory of Kenneth Schleicher, and I still want to get a penguin tattooed for the moments he shared and what that meant to a boy just wanting a father, something I never got to tell him. Thank you.
That story about tattoos came from Daniel Schleicher while he was incarcerated in Oregon, Wisconsin. His story is featured in the newest season of the human-powered podcast, Humanity Unlocked, which is focusing on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, no one lives forever, but someone's memories, the stories of their lives, those can stand the test of time. It's just a matter of someone telling those stories and someone listening. A project in Sheboygan collects those stories from local elders and puts them on stage in a variety of art forms. We're going to meet the organizers of that project and hear one of those stories, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you collected stories from somebody, maybe an older member of your family, or if you are that older member of a family, have you shared your stories with someone else? What do you do to commemorate those stories? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Colleen Makut is the founder of the Live Forever Project in Sheboygan, which does just that, keeps elders' memories alive through the arts. She studied musical theater at UW-Stevens Point, got her bachelor's degree in elementary education, now teaches drama and social studies in Sheboygan. Colleen, welcome to Central Time.
Greetings. Thank you for having me on.
And Claire Carlson is a Live Forever Project collaborator. Claire, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Colleen, what was the inspiration for this Live Forever Project?
Yeah, it really goes back to my grandparents, actually. It has its roots back in 2014 and inspired by my grandfather, Eugene, and my grandmother, Alice. Eugene was a soldier in World War II, and Alice was, you know, on the home front fighting at home during the war. And there came a point in time where I realized that I didn't know if I could tell their stories as well as they could, and if I knew them well enough to tell them again. And they had always told me their stories as I was growing up, but there was a kind of a little bit of a scare because they were in a car accident, and it ended up being something that was very small. They had just slid off the road, but I didn't know for a while when I had heard of that had happened, you know, if they were okay. And I realized that in that moment, you know, memories can disappear and they're gone. And about that same time in my life, I was looking for a bigger reason to do my art forms. So why do I get on stage? Why do I write poetry? Why do I sing? Those kinds of things. And those two ideas kind of coalesced in my mind. And I realized that this could be my reason for doing my art forms. This could be my mission. And that's kind of how it all started.
And Claire, what brought you on board sharing your art in this project?
Well, in my personal life, my background is also in music. I have an undergrad in voice, and I was always interested in singing and acting. My whole life, I've dabbled in visual arts and all kinds of creative goodness, writing poetry. And then when my professional life started, I found myself working with the elder population a lot. So I'm a program coordinator at the John Michael Kohler Arts Center in Sheboygan, and I run a program for adults with memory loss called Spark, and I also run a workshop series for adults 55 and up called ArtLinks Sheboygan. And so my personal world, my professional world kind of tied all these motivations together. And back in 2021, Colleen was looking for a way to get LFP to potentially collaborate with the Art Center, and we sat down just as potential colleagues. Mm. And at the time, it wasn't the right moment for the Art Center to collaborate with LFP, but it was totally the right time for me as Claire, the person, to get on board. So I was thrilled. I said, "Do you let people audition, or, you know, how can I?" And she said, "Of course, we'd love to do something with you." So it was serendipitous and lovely.
And Colleen, your next performance, the first since the beginning of the pandemic, is coming up Saturday, September 23rd. It features 96-year-old Evelyn Prevenis. I talked to her. We're going to listen to that in a minute. Just briefly, tell us a bit about Evelyn and why you wanted to put her story on stage.
Yeah, she's just a very engaging person and a very caring person and someone who really embraces differences between people, really embraces this essence of freedom and exhilaration and exuberance. And I was just very personally inspired by her and these themes that kind of run through her life. And, you know, just very honored to have her sharing her stories with us. I feel like we're the ones who are lucky to be able to hear these people share their lives with us and to be able to take these stories and tell them. So
I was lucky enough to talk to Evelyn Prevenis on Friday. Here's a listen. Now, I can't imagine what it would be like to have somebody do a show about my life. How does it feel to have this performance based on your story?
Oh, it's a thrill. You know, I keep telling, I have this thing I want saying to any older citizen, share your stories with whoever will listen, because someday they will come back and somebody will remember it and you will live forever.
And now you're working with the Live Forever Project. Like, what, practically, what are you doing with them? What does the process look like?
Well, originally, a friend of mine told me about the program. And this was at the beginning when COVID first started. And I live in a senior apartment building, so we were basically in a lockdown. We couldn't have anybody come into our apartment unless they were family members. If we left our apartment, we had to wear a face mask, et cetera, and keep social distancing. And Colleen had called me and wanted to do an interview. And we're trying to figure out how we're going to manage this, you know, with this lockdown. But we managed to do it in our community room in the building. They sat way on one side of the room, and I sat way on the other side. We're all wearing masks, and there's a tape recorder in front of me. But I hadn't been able to talk to anybody for a whole long time, so the stories just poured out of me.
And I understand you're going to be performing yourself. Can you read some of the poem that you wrote for the performance?
Yes, I can. Do you want me to read the whole thing or just part of it?
I'll go ahead and read the whole thing.
Okay. This is Ode to the Second Jetty. Where did you come from? You were not there when children played on the pristine beach, explored the trees on the bluff, or waited on the slippery rocks of the point. Then suddenly it seemed there you were with your brothers. A new place to play, bulwarks to climb, a place to jump into the water, a place to sunbathe on your smooth, sun-warmed surface. You have felt the sun warming you, the cold northeast wind buffeting you, the ice and snow of winter shrouding you and the shore. You have felt the damp fingers of fog that hide you from sight. Oh, the things you have seen, tens of thousands of sunrises, moonbeams sparkling on the night waters. You have seen the stars circling the skies above you. You have seen meteor showers when the city sleeps. You have seen rockets soar into the heavens and strange stars bloom in the sky when a country celebrates. You have seen the winking lights of passing planes and satellites. You have seen the passing coal and ore boats, the fishing boats, the water skiers and surfers. You saw the young woman spread her towel on your sun-warmed surface. You saw the young curly-haired man swim up and join her. You saw the beginning of a romance. You saw them return again and again with children, grandchildren, pets, and friends. On a windy November day, you saw the not-so-young woman return with children and grandchildren to say goodbye to the not-so-young curly-haired man. You heard the rifle fire. You saw the flag folded. You saw them leave. But now, your once smooth surface is pockmarked and broken from the assault of wind and waves. How many storms have you withstood? How many waves have endlessly pounded you? But you remain strong and defiant, carrying on as you were meant to do, protecting, guarding. Remain strong. Be there when the not-so-young woman returns to rejoin the not-so-young curly-haired man.
That's a beautiful poem. Thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate it.
The people that are involved in the whole project have done such a wonderful job with it. They've written a skit about showing how we met, which they're acting out. John Dahl has written the most beautiful piece of music that makes everybody cry. So it's going to be very interesting.
Now, I have to ask about the skydiving. Now, you're 96 now. You started when you were 79. I've never skydived. I can't imagine starting now. What led you to try it?
Well, one of my younger boys went to this airport, small airport, and he was just going to do a static jump, you know, the type where you jump out of the plane and the chute opens immediately, and it's a solo jump. But while we were there watching this, we saw a larger chute coming down with two people attached. And I thought that looked very interesting and didn't think much more about it. Well, maybe about a year later, the same son told us he was going to do a tandem skydive. So, of course, the whole family had to go along to watch again. And I said, when I saw his face when he landed, I decided I want to do that too. So the following fall, about six or seven members of our family went skydiving, three of my sons, a couple of daughter-in-laws, a grandson. We all went skydiving that day. Not at once, you know, each one was an individual jump, but it was one of the most exciting things I've ever done.
And you've done it again.
Yes, I did it about, I always tell people, it's skydiving is addictive. Because I went at least seven times, and I think I would have continued going, but the people that were running this skydive adventure decided to retire and move to Florida. So there isn't a place close by here that we can go to. I'd have to go halfway across the state to do it. Plus, it's a little harder getting in and out of a plane, et cetera, et cetera.
Evelyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to.
That's Sheboygan's Evelyn Prevenis, 96 years old, featured in an upcoming performance of the Live Forever Project. We'll hear more about what that performance will look like coming up on Central Time.
What lovely jewels you have, miss. I adore your necklace.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a clip from the song Wallpaper Doll, written by one of our guests, Colleen Makut, for a performance at the Live Forever Project. She founded in Sheboygan to chronicle and share the lives of local elders. Claire Carlson also with us, a collaborator on the project. Colleen, we just heard from Evelyn there. I went longer with her than I planned to because she has great stories to tell. Can you tell us now how you take her stories and what's going to end up on stage later this month?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's been an interesting process that we've been working on for a while now, and I've just felt really blessed to have so many local people on board and invested in the project. And I just thank every single person who's involved. You know, we have a core group of people who meet regularly, and it started out with looking over in Evelyn's interview transcripts, which were plentiful with stories, and kind of reading and talking about them and talking about the themes that really stood out to us as these stories capture this person and capture their essence and could really, you know, really speak to us. So each artist involved, you know, looked at the stories and said, this one speaks to me. This one sparks an idea, a creative idea for me. I can relate to this story. I can connect to it. So every single person who has created something for this show has done so in a way that is meaningful to them. And everyone has different emphasis as far as their art forms. We have songwriters, we have visual artists, we have dancers, we have some theatrical skits, music. Part of the purpose also is to unify the art forms for that cause. And so it's just been really cool to see everybody coming together. So the performance itself captures the bigger picture of Evelyn's life, but it tells it through smaller vignettes that kind of focus on a certain art form or a certain story. But some of them are also multi-art forms. So you'll see dance combined with songwriting. You'll see visual art combined with, you know, movement and storytelling and things like that.
And Claire, can you talk a little bit about taking somebody's life story like Evelyn's and how you contribute to an event like this?
Yeah. So I actually am unfortunately not involved with the Evelyn story at this time, but I've been involved with all kinds of other LFP things. So, but I can relay that in regard to a lovely lady named Shirley, whose life story we were looking at. And I remember for me, the process of turning Shirley's world into art was just reading the transcript and kind of waiting for that lightning bolt feeling, to hit that light bulb moment. And so in her case, so much of it was set in the 1950s. And I kept seeing the color palette that I associate with that time, the mint green, the butter yellow, the pale pink. And so I wrote a poem that really utilizes those colors to paint a picture of that moment in her life that I was illustrating. And the environment that Colleen creates when we get together to generate this work is really, really encouraging and open. And so if anybody has any trepidation about like, well, I've always wanted to write poetry, but I don't know if I'm good enough, this is the cohort to join. This is the group of people to align yourself with. It's so nurturing and open and kind. It's a totally safe environment, which helps everybody get produce more.
Thanks to both of our guests, Colleen McCoot and Claire Carlson with the Live Forever Project in Sheboygan. We talked to them about how they tell the life stories of local elders through artistic performances. Their upcoming show, You Might As Well Enjoy Yourself, based on the life of Evelyn Prevenis, who we heard from earlier. It's going to be Saturday, September 23rd at 2:30 p.m. You can check out the Live Forever Project on Facebook or liveforever-project.org. We've got a link also at wpr.org/centraltime for more info about the event. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our exercise needs and abilities can change over the years. We'll get advice on adapting our fitness plans through the decades. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we look at why so many Americans have stopped going to church with an author of the new book called The Great De-Churching. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Over the last 25 years, an estimated 40 million Americans have stopped attending church. There are lots of different reasons, ranging from a lack of time or motivation to leaving deliberately because of negative experiences or loss of faith. Now, for the first time in history, the number of Americans who never go to church is outpacing the number who attend weekly. According to our next guest, this large-scale unchurching isn't just a concern for individual congregations or denominations that are losing membership. It's a change that can hold up a mirror to American politics and society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your story. Did you regularly attend a worship service? Maybe every week? Has that declined? What led to that? Or have you left altogether? If you're still going, are you seeing empty pews in your neighborhood more and more? What do you think might be behind that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Burge is an associate professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, where he researches religion in the United States. He did the research and data analysis for a new book called The Great De-Churching. Who's leaving? Why are they going, and what will it take to bring them back? Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Always a pleasure to be here.
We've talked before, Ryan, on the show about your work on the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people leaving religious affiliation. And it seems like this amazingly big social trend that for a lot of people is under the radar. Can you talk about the scale, the scope of this de-churching and where it fits into American history?
Yeah, I've been telling people that I think this is the biggest cultural shift of the last 100 years. I mean, we've never seen this many people leave institutions at the rate they're leaving. According to this book, 40 million people have de-churched over the last 25 years. That is more than the number of people who became Christian during the first and second Great Awakening and all the Billy Graham Crusades combined. So if all those gains that American history has seen towards Christianity have all basically been lost over the last two or three decades during the Great De-Churching.
when we've talked in the past, the mainstream Protestant denominations seem to be having a lot of the biggest losses, and that's been going on over time. Same with Catholics. In the new book, there's a lot of focus on research on evangelical Christianity. What are we seeing there? Are they starting to see the same kinds of trends?
Yeah, for a while, they really were exploding rapidly. In 1972, about 17% of Americans were evangelical. But around 1993, the share of Americans who are evangelical got to 30%. That's the highest it's ever been. And from that point forward, it's really been nothing but a slow and steady decline. Today in America, about 21, 22% of Americans identify as evangelical, so down 8% from their peak. And all the evidence is pointing to the fact that evangelicalism is not going to be able to, you know, resist the trend towards secularization. Obviously, you know, Catholics and mainline Protestants have lost a lot more, but evangelicalism is not nearly as strong nor as cohesive as it was in America even 20 or 30 years ago.
Now, a key point here is de-churching, no longer attending church at all or on a regular basis, isn't necessarily the same as de-faithing. And as you break down different groups of people, a lot of people who have left church may still keep at least some sort of the faith they left. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So really what I love about this book is these two pastors, Jim Davis and Michael Graham, came to me and said, we have this idea for a book. Can you help us? Can you do the data for it? And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. So my friend Paul Jupe and I did all the data behind the scenes. They were really focused on an interesting aspect of religion that the scholars don't think about a lot. And that is not people who we think a lot about, people who used to be evangelical and now are none, for instance. This book is about people who used to attend church at least once a month or more, and now describe their attendance as seldom or never, so less than once a year. And this is such an interesting aspect because sometimes people can de-church, but not de-evangelical or de-Catholic or de-mainline. They still identify as, you know, evangelical or mainline or Catholic, but they haven't gone to church in decades. So in some ways, they're still religious from a belonging perspective, but from a behavior perspective, they're not religious at all.
Let's look at some of the different categories of people and why they left church. One is, this is interesting to me, casually de-churched. We're a busy society. It can be hard to find time to hang out with our friends and family. And sometimes it sounds like for a lot of people, that church habit just sort of gradually falls by the wayside.
Yeah, that to me is the biggest takeaway from this book. And the thing that I learned more than anything else is the number one reason people de-church in America over the last 30 years is not because of politics. It's not because of theology. It's actually because they moved. Something so incredibly basic. You know, we hear these stories about these dramatic, like, I walked out of church because they took a stand on LGBTQ or abortion or women pastors or kind of these big social issues. What really happens for most people, according to this research, is they sort of slowly slide away from religion over time. There's not this like single inflection point where they were, you know, they were going every week and they stopped going at all. You know, they went every week and then they went once a month and then they went once every 2 or 3 months. And then now they're going once a year. And then all of a sudden they haven't gone in 3 or 4 years. And it's not really a conscious decision on a lot of their parts. A lot of it's just they sort of got away, got out of the habit, and just don't really feel a strong pull to get back in that habit, back to church.
We are talking to Ryan Burge about his work on this new book, The Great De-Churching, looking at this big movement, kind of under the radar for some people, about people leaving churches. The research here focuses on Christianity in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lots of callers. Let's start talking to you. Rob is with us in Wausau. Rob, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to kind of say that church is becoming too political, and I stay home with my children and we still have faith and I try to teach them, you know, the right way, but just the politicalness and it's just going too far.
Rob, thanks a lot for the call. And Ryan, in the book, there's two categories of people who might agree with that. People on the left, let's put that really loosely, who don't agree with their church's teaching, maybe on LGBTQ issues or abortion or Donald Trump or you name it, and people in the book described as a secular right who think the church teachings are too liberal or not political enough. Can you talk about, Rob, certainly not alone in that.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, churches can't win, right? They're too much or not enough of left or right. And I think, honestly, the perception here is different than the reality. You know, in other surveys, we've asked people who go to church every week, has your pastor spoken about any of these issues over the last 12 months from the pulpit? And we're talking everything from immigration to healthcare to abortion, you know, big issues and small issues. And one third of people say their pastor's not mentioned a single issue in the last 12 months. And 52% chose one issue or zero issue from that list of 10. So I think some of that is perception. And pastors are not dumb. They're very strategic about how they act on Sunday morning. And they realize by being political, they're feeding into Rob's problem, which is they're being too much of this thing and not enough of the other thing. If you're Michael Jordan was once asked, why aren't you not more political? And he said, because Republicans buy sneakers too. You know, pastors, they realize that if you go out on the limb on this issue to the left or this issue to the right, you're going to alienate a part of your congregation either way. And so I think a lot of pastors have tried to take the middle way and really not got into the politics as much as they possibly can.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Before we go back to our callers, I want to meet another category of people you separate out in the book who have de-churched. Ex-evangelicals.
Yeah, that's such a category online. Ex-evangelicals are people who grew up in the evangelical church. For instance, I grew up in the evangelical church, and now in the 1990s, by the way, which you look back at like the data, that's when peak evangelicalism was happening. There were more evangelicals than ever before. They're politically and culturally more were stronger than they've ever been, and now they faded a bit. But, you know, a lot of those kids now who grew up evangelical in their 30s and 40s and really thinking back on the purity culture and the gender roles and the politics, and they're the ones who not only left the evangelical church behind, they spend a lot of their time being critical of the evangelical church, have no desire to go back. They still believe in Jesus and the Bible and a lot of Christian orthodoxy. They just really dislike everything that evangelicalism represents in American culture, politics, and society.
Let's go back to our callers. Jonah is with us in Oakwood. Jonah, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be calling in.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about Jonah?
So I grew up in the church. I was a Christian for, I guess you could say, 20 years then. I'm 24 now. And like 15 of those I remember very vividly. And the biggest thing I took away from it the entire time was not necessarily God's love or the love of my church to me, but it was the shame. That was the biggest thing that I took away. Yeah.
Jonah, can I ask what denomination, if you're willing to share that with us?
Yeah. Non-denominational, which itself is a denomination, and I think it's kind of funny that we call ourselves that.
Jonah, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Okay, a couple big points there I want to get into, Ryan. First of all, non-denominational churches, this is one of the categories, one of the few categories that has still been growing lately, right, Ryan?
Oh, man, I think that's really the only bright spot in American Christianity right now, especially American evangelicalism, is non-denominational. So if you look at the Southern Baptists, they're down 3 million people from 2006. The Presbyterian Church USA went from 3.1 million in 1984 to 1.1 million today. You can go down the list. Almost every major denomination has suffered, you know, catastrophic losses of membership over the last 10 or 15 years. Really, the only group that's grown is non-denominationals. In the 1970s, only 3% of Americans identified as non-denominational. Almost 15% of Americans identify as non-denominational. In the future, most evangelicals are going to be non-denominational Christians, and we always think of them as evangelical. Even though not every non-denominational church is evangelical, the vast majority, the joke is they basically look like Southern Baptists without the name, you know, in terms of theology and practice and things like that. And, you know, the experience with shame is very real in the evangelical church. A lot of talk about sinfulness and judgment in the end times, and it makes you think a lot about who you are and what you're doing, and shame is definitely a part of the evangelical tradition, without a doubt.
Jonah, thanks a lot for the call. And Ryan, your co-authors in this book, the pastors, talk about walking a fine line between, you know, wanting to present a gospel of love that might appeal to someone like Jonah, but not giving up on articles of faith and saying, yeah, there are certain behaviors we really think you ought to do if you're a Christian.
That's the I've always heard that good preachers should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And how much you do of each one of those every Sunday really depends on what the passage is, what's going on in the world. And sometimes I think pastors do a little bit too much and not enough. We all need a pat on the head and a kick in the behind every once in a while. You know, do better, be a better Christian, be a better person. We also need to know you're doing pretty good and God loves you just the way you are. It's hard to hold those two things in tension sometimes.
Thanks again for that call, Jonah. We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He researches religion in the U.S. We're talking about his contributions to the new book, The Great Dechurching, which looks at why many Americans have stopped going to church and what it means for the country we live in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or your congregation? Have you seen this in your life or in your church? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Ryan Burge, political scientist, about the new book, The Great Dechurching. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're one of the millions of Americans who stopped going to church, love to hear from you and hear your story. If you're still there and seeing empty seats, love to hear your thoughts on why that might be. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Good afternoon. I'm a nominal Presbyterian, so I guess I'm part of that dying breed. But I have seen, you know, shrinkage in the church when I go. I think this is a prime example of William Butler Yeats's most famous line: "The best lack all conviction; the worst are full of passionate intensity." And by this point, I've been involved in a lot of movements, political movements, you'd have to call them, and when people come around and immediately identify themselves as Christians, my hair is stand on end. Usually the Christians that we're going to be allies with don't put that up first thing.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Ryan, Randy pointing, I think, toward political polarization in wider American culture. How do we see that playing out in churches and whether people stay or go?
Yeah, if you look at the data, what Randy's talking about is ideas religion as a cultural and political identity, not necessarily a religious identity anymore. We're seeing the rise of the share of people who identify as evangelical but never go to church. Which is an interesting phenomenon. The more you think about it, the more you realize they're grabbing onto that label because they like the political and cultural connotation of what the word evangelical means, even though they don't really believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, let's say. And I think that's really what we're seeing in America is that religion's become almost like a totem, like a marker, almost like I root for the Yankees. Like I'm an evangelical, even though I don't really watch the games, even though I don't really go to church. Because I like where that puts me in social and political space. It identifies who I'm with and who I'm against. And I think a lot of liberal Christians in America see that and go, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I'm not going to say it. Because when I say Christian, the average person thinks Republican or conservative, and I'm not those things. So I won't lead with that idea. It's just interesting how in the 1980s, you know, Christians were evenly divided, Republican and Democrat, and now they're overwhelmingly Republican, especially white Christians. Now that liberal Christians have seen that, they've sort of pulled back from that identity as part of themselves.
Thanks a lot for that call, Randy, at 800-642-1234. Ryan, before we go back to our callers, I want to check out another group now, a category of people leaving churches. You just mentioned white Christians. You have a category called BIPOC, the Black Indigenous People of Color. What story did you see there?
Oh, it's such an interesting story, Rob, because we used an algorithm for this, which is a computer generated, AI thing that creates these clusters. And we did not include a race variable on purpose because we didn't want it to use race. But the algorithm, for some reason, put everyone who was a person of color in our sample of dechurched evangelicals into this one cluster of BIPOC. What's really interesting about them is they have really high levels of education and really high incomes. And I wonder if a lot of the reason they're leaving is the politics that we're talking about, because white Christianity has become something else entirely compared to, you know, Christianity for people of color. Black Protestants, almost 90% of them voted for Joe Biden in 2020, when it was 80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. So I wonder if a lot of people of color who are raised in evangelical traditions have left those traditions because they want to distance themselves from the MAGA Republicans they see taking over, you know, modern evangelicalism.
Let's go back to your calls now. Bryce is with us in Wauwatosa. Bryce, hello.
Hello, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you so much for accepting my call. It is rather appropriate that you talk about the BIPOC aspect of your research. I am African American. I was raised in the United Methodist Church with my father being a United Methodist pastor in Indiana for a 30-year period. I am 53 years of age. And as time has progressed and as I have gotten further away from my family, I have pretty much accepted agnosticism as my way of looking at belief at this point in my life, to comfortably say, I don't know, which in a general sense, my understanding is that's what agnosticism represents. And I'm comfortable in saying that. Number two, and then I will close. In the United Methodist tradition, I'm sure your author is very well aware of this, recently there has been a seismic shift within that denomination in that the issues of LGBTQ have come to the forefront in the faith, and quite a few people are starting to leave either individually or collectively from the United Methodist faith as a result. So quite a few things are changing from whence I was a preacher's boy sitting in the front row listening to Dad give the word. Thank Bryce. You all so much.
Bryce, thank you so much for sharing your personal story, first of all. And Ryan, to Bryce's second point, LGBT issues, a lot of disjunction there between society at large and what's going on in these churches. How big a factor is that in de-churching?
So the United Methodist Church is seeing the largest denominational schism in American history right now. I don't think we're talking about this enough. It used to be 8 million people. Over 20% of those churches have disaffiliated over the last 18 months and joined what's called the Global Methodist Church, which is the more conservative branch of United Methodism now. So it's going to create an entirely new religious landscape. We are seeing a lot of young people who maybe not be LGBTQ themselves, but are allies of LGBTQ people, growing up evangelical especially, and going, I can't be part of a congregation that does not allow those people to be full members and do their weddings like they would do my heterosexual wedding. So I think there's a, if you even look at young evangelicals, by the way, a majority of young evangelicals, 18 to 35 year olds, are now in favor of same-sex marriage. So it's a situation where the bottom up is overwhelmingly in favor of same-sex marriage, especially amongst non-Christian young people. But the institutions are holding true to their doctrine they preached for hundreds of years. And at some point, things are going to have to change in one way or the other as those churches continue to empty out.
Thanks again for that call. I want to talk a little about the impact of this, Ryan. Obviously, if you're a pastor, you're very worried about this. If you're a member of a church, you're very concerned. There's also concerns raised in the book about, you know, this is a great opportunity for people to participate in a community. And these are institutions that often do a lot of work, whether it's in education or health or social services. What are some of the impacts of de-churching, even for people who maybe didn't church in the first place?
Yeah, Perry Bacon wrote this great op-ed for the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago called "I Used to Be a Christian, Now I Miss Church," and where he kind of lays out this idea. He grew up in church just like Bryce did, you know, in an African American household, and he was there every Sunday with his dad, front row. And now he doesn't believe in a lot of the doctrines, but he has a deep ache for the community and the volunteerism that church provided for him and his family. I think a lot of people forget that churches are also social organizations. They're horizontal organizations that help us connect with each other and then serve the community. And so I wonder, you know, how are we going to generate social capital in the future? Who's going to run the clothes closets and the food pantries and the soup kitchens, all the things that we're doing, these little communities across America? They're going to disappear in 20 or 30 years as the great de-churching accelerates. Who's going to fill the gaps? Who's going to step in? We obviously don't want the government to do that. Most Americans want a smaller government, not a larger one. And I love my atheist agnostic friends, but they have not shown an ability to organize these, you know, volunteer organizations in a way that can replace Christian organizations that are dying. And I worry about people on the fringes being left behind, left out, and lost because these church organizations aren't going to exist anymore.
Briefly, Ryan, is that necessarily the case? Your co-authors found room for optimism for revitalizing church communities in our last half a minute. Do you think that's a possibility?
Listen, there's always, you know, the pendulum swings both ways, right? So it's really, we're moving way far towards secularization right now, but you see little green shoots in certain religious communities that are doing very well. For instance, the Orthodox Church in America is doing very well. Traditional Catholics who go back to the Latin Mass are doing very well. So I think religion's going to be remade in a different way. We're going to see new religious movements over the next 15 or 20 years, but a lot of pastors are facing issues like now, like how to get rid of their pulpits and choir robes and hymnals. And those are not easy conversations to have going forward.
Ryan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. We've been talking about his contribution to the new book, The Great Dechurching. Who's leaving? Why are they going? And what will it take to bring them back? You can keep sharing your stories. You can email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.